Have a seat. And this will be the last group of speakers for the day. I gave Mr. Shemek and his team an hour, and has a PowerPoint presentation, and I think everybody is ready to go. So if you can set the timer for an hour, please. Thank you. So Mr. Right. Shimmick.
Here we go. Mr. Young and
Mr. Johnson.
Steve Shimmick with the Otter Project in Monterey Coast Keeper, and I'm joined by Mr. Ben Pitterly from Santa Barbara Channel Keeper, and Elliot Higgins and Savannah Schultz-Fletcher from Stanford Environmental Law Clinic. So we've been given an hour. We have essentially three presentations to give you. Those presentations will not be seamless between them. They were kind of developed independently. We'll all be able to deal with that and live with it. So my part of this will go for about 20 minutes, and what I'm going to talk about is what we knew on the ground, some of the problems with the ag order, when we knew them, and how much time did we have to adjust, and maybe we did or maybe we did not make those adjustments. So generally, as I speak, I want to make the point that this is our water, and it was highly polluted in 2004 and 2005 when the first ag order was created. It was highly polluted in 2012 when the second order was polluted, and I believe it's the same today and will be the same tomorrow. I'm going to cover these topics so you can see that I am going to roll along, and I apologize to the court reporter in advance.
But you're doing well so far.
Yeah. Basically, what I want to point out is that there'll be essentially three slides per topic, sometimes more, sometimes less, but usually right around three. A first slide introducing what I'm talking about, a second slide in the middle, and then a third slide that will be the slide that says, okay, here's what we knew and when we knew it and how much time we had to adjust. Okay, so it's that third slide that you should pay attention to. And in the upper left-hand corner of the slide, it will have one of these topics there, so you can stay where we're at. Why are we doing this? Why are we talking about how much time we had? Well, let me read you from the staff report. The staff report says, given the limited time frame available for the preparation of proposed Ag Order 3.0 and the pending legal and policy decisions that will affect the Central Coast Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program, staff proposes Ag Order 3.0 as temporary interim order. So the premise here is we don't have time. I maintain you did and you blew it. So that's part of it. And then also, I want you to make the distinction between the regulatory pieces of the order, and this is something that I think you've touched on a little bit, the regulatory pieces of the order, and then the monitoring and reporting requirements. Again, let me read you from the staff report. The regulatory requirements of proposed Ag Order 3.0 are largely the same as Ag Order 2.0. You are about to pass an Ag Order which regulates chlorpyrifos and diazinon, which are no longer in use. You have not added imidacloprid. You are simply going to monitor imidacloprid. You're not going to regulate it in any way, shape, or form. You should be, but you're not. So keep in mind there's those two parts of the order. And that second part of the order, the monitoring and reporting requirements, all you're going to do is document degradation. Are you going to protect water quality? No. You're going to document degradation. And so the really important question comes, when are you going to start talking about and applying benchmarks and standards? I maintain that this order is not progressively iterative. This order, as has been referred to in the staff reports, is an extension of the old order. So I apologize in advance. Put on your helmets. I'm about to pound on the board a little bit. So I apologize. I love you all. Tiering. So this is the first set of three slides. I'll go a little bit slower through this one. The ag order relies on tiering. And it's widely acknowledged. In fact, there was a slide that was put up during the development of the 2012 order that basically said Tier 1 is less regulatory and less restrictive than the 2005 order. Tier 2 was about the same, and Tier 3 was more restrictive. Some of you that were here probably remember that slide. So my point is that you're relying upon Tier 3 to make the improvement from the 2005 to the 2012 order. It's only Tier 3 that is more restrictive. Well, let's talk about what happened to Tier 3. During the development of the 2012 order, staff originally estimated that there would be about 11% of discharges, that's about 480 discharges, in Tier 3, and about 54% of the acreage. This is what you told us Tier 3 was going to look like. And we all were on board on that because we all said, wow, Tier 3 is where the action is, and you're going to focus, and within Tier 3, you're going to encompass about 54% of the acreage. As you know, during the 2012 process, it got weakened and weakened and weakened. And then where it ended up is you said, well, with changes, there's going to be about 100 operations and about 14% of the acreage. But here's where you ended up today. There are 24 operations in Tier 3. 24 operations in Tier 3 out of thousands. 20,000 acres, or about 4.74% of your total acreage. And it gets even worse than that. Of those 24 operations, 10 self-report they have no discharge. Now, to me, that doesn't pass the straight face test. I sure hope somebody else has gone out and looked, because to be in Tier 3, you have to say that you're discharging into an impaired waterway. That's one of the ways you get into Tier 3. Or you have to be using chlorpyrifos and diazinon, which are high-risk pesticides, and that's a way. And so how, given that there's storm, you know, we're talking about stormwater discharge and we're talking about tailwater discharge, how there cannot be stormwater discharge of these growers, I have no idea. But I'm hoping somebody went out and looked. Here's what we learned. So this is that wrap-up slide. For whatever reason, Tier 3 failed to contain a significant number of operations or acreage. When we knew it during enrollment. Amount of time to adjust, 4.5 years. You've had 4.5 years. And if I recall correctly, and I believe I do, at that last board meeting when people said, oh, what happens if they switch pesticides? We'll take the time and we'll adjust. Well, what happens if Tier 3, which you're relying upon, is ineffective and you've known it for 4.5 years? This was reported to the board. So that's part of my theme. Who's driving the bus here? Staff has consistently reported to you these failings. I believe you're driving the bus. And I believe you had the responsibility to say, wait a second, this isn't working. Pesticide switching, there's been a lot of talk about that already today. There's your Tier 3 criteria. And here's from DPR, agricultural pesticide use for Monterey County alone. So this is very close to Karen Wooster's slide, but look at what was happening with chlorpyrifos and diazinon. even before you created the 2012 order, those were falling out of use. So, of course, agriculture was fine with you regulating an order that focused on chlorpyrifos and diazinon. They knew that it was falling from use. They knew it. But look, imidacloprid and permethrins, they're growing. And look at the total pounds of pesticides. So this is not the total pounds of pesticide of those four pesticides. This is total pounds of pesticide used in Monterey County through the years. And look at those pounds. It's gone up. People have switched. They haven't used less pesticide. What we learned that growers switch pesticides. When we knew it, we knew this before the ag order was even put in place. I remember Mr. Young asking the question, what happens if they switch? I remember me asking that question. And we were told, well, if they switch, we'll adjust. You had 4.5 years to adjust. Down-tiering. So this one's a little bit different. Do you have the ability to adjust? At least 130 operations asked for down-tiering. And I want to make it clear, I'm not against down-tiering. If they qualify to be down-tiered, of course they should be down-tiered. I'm not against it. But it took you a matter of days to a matter of weeks to down-tier a grower. And you down-tiered many growers and many operations and many individual ranches. So you adjusted with down-tiering, but you didn't adjust to anything else. So you have the ability to adjust. So I have to believe that you just didn't do it the other way. Human right to water. This one's probably the weakest of these slides, although I think it's almost the most important. The legislature passed the human right to water in 2012. I believe, and UC Berkeley, with all due respect to my Stanford friends, UC Berkeley suggested that human right to water required a specific response, not just a sentence or two saying, yep, we've complied with human right to water. But it required a specific response of how have you complied with the human right to water? How have you, did you refrain from adopting policies or regulations? How long have you known about the human right to water and that you were going to have to comply with that? It was passed on September 25th, 2012. You knew it September 25th, 2012. You had 4.5 years. To create text around human right to water. New impairments. You've seen this slide. The Cooperative Monitoring Program, that's what CMP stands for in that last column. Your and Agriculture's Monitoring Program found no toxicity. When it was followed up by Granite Canyon, they found toxicity in 8 of 9, the same sampling sites, 8 of 9. Now, with all respect to staff, and I have total respect for Ms. Wooster, it's not about that we need more sampling. It's about the fact that what you've done is you've missed 8 of 9 impairments in these waterways, and you are not addressing these impairments. So what have you decided to do? You've decided to document the degradation. Let's document it. Let's have more monitoring. Now, I'm not saying that this documentation is all bad. I'm simply saying that it doesn't solve anything. And your job is a regulatory agency. You're not an educational agency. You're not a get-along, you know, come along, I want to get along, and so you're just going to do the same thing agency. There's a phrase I'm missing there somehow. But you are an agency that regulates. And I believe even education operates better if there's a backstop of regulation. How to incentivize people? Create a regulation that you must achieve a certain ratio of applied to, you know, whether it be removed or whether whatever way that you create the ratio, there are specific ways you could do it. And then you're going to incentivize those growers to figure out how to do it. I'm optimistic. Believe it or not, I believe that you have the best growers in the world, and if you give them a target and say you must meet this, they will meet it. And what's missing here is you have not given them targets. Again, we knew this. It was in the staff report, so now being very generous, we knew that they were going to switch, and we knew that there were going to be new impairments. We've known this all along. We knew that these new impairments existed. There was plenty of data. There was actually scientific research. But there was an executive officer's report to this board on May 2015 alerting you to the fact that there were these new impairments being caused by these new pesticides. This is not about documenting the degradation. This is about what you're going to do about it. Anti-deg, we've talked about that. I'm going to go very quickly through that. Basically, anti-deg, there's been three different rulings. The first was in 2012, an appellate court ruling. Then there was a 2013 ruling. And then there was a ruling by Judge Frawley on this order in 2015. So starting in 2012, you knew you had to do a degradation analysis. Did you get started? No. I believe that you're missing that BPTC, best practicable treatment and control, which is the final step, which is the step that says, here's what we're going to do, okay? You have now caught up with step one and step two, but strangely, you haven't done the third step in this order. And again, 4 years and 4 months to do it. Total nutrient applied data, we've known that growers were over-applying. And again, you actually had data in hand October 1st, 2014. The report to the board was 1 year ago, March 18th. What's the take-home here? The take-home here is you're still not creating a ratio. You removed the ratio, the requirement for the ratio, on March 15th, 2012, when you passed the order, if you recall. It was the thing that you gave back to ag at the last second. You said, okay, we'll remove the ratio. You can do it. You just didn't, and you didn't again. You're documenting the degradation. Do you need more data to tell you that lettuce growers are over-applying fertilizer? Do you really need new data? So, yes, it'll help, and it'll help with all these other crops, but you knew it. Done that. Photo monitoring. It's been said. My point is that, first of all, there used to be a ton of water. This one's just fine. In 1896, San Francisco looked to the Salinas Valley as a source of water, specifically the lakes around the city of Salinas, as the new source of water for San Francisco because it was so abundant. The riparian quarter was thought to be 1 mile wide. Here's something that just shows this. In 1989, those yellow markers are not going to change. And now farm fields where those yellow markers are. The photo monitoring was meant to stop the destruction of riparian and wetland habitat. You need to do this work. You have not. So my problem is not with the photo monitor. I'm not hung up on that requirement. My problem is you have not replaced it with anything except goodwill. And I love staff. I love this board. But I don't have a terrible abundance of goodwill to give right now. I don't know that you're going to do it until I see it in print. I'm sorry. Coast Keeper versus State Board. This is an interesting one. I'm not going to hit you over the head with the requirements of what the State Board said were the faults and the problems of the order. What I am going to say is that you had a court decision and a ruling on September 30th, and gee whiz, on February 8th, 4 months later, the State Board came out with their draft East San Joaquin order, and guess what the footnote says? The footnote says, acknowledges that Judge Frawley came out with the order, and then says, we also discuss and reference conclusions of the Sacramento Superior Court ruling where relevant. Why is that? That's because in 4 months, they adjusted the order to consider Judge Frawley's ruling. You've had more time than 4 months, and you can't seem to adjust to Judge Frawley's ruling at all. But yet it was done by the State Board in 4 months in a bigger area. Imidacloprid, here's something you can do something about very quickly, and it won't be popular with Chair Wolf. I'm sorry. I'm about to turn Chair Wolf into Tier 2 if my way happens.
Give me some loving.
So what we had was we had the SIP program stand up before you and say, yep, they use imidacloprid. Imidacloprid, and this is according to DPR, is a threat to groundwater, highly toxic, and is persistent. And guess what? Look where the greatest amount of imidacloprid is used, in grapes, wine grapes. Should you be down-tiering SIP program knowing this? I think not. I'm done. I'm passing it on to Mr. Ben Pitterly. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Ben Pitterly with Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. And I've been, I've been involved in participating in the development of this order since, I think it was 2008, when the original stakeholder process began leading up to the 2012 renewal. But my work at the Santa Barbara Channel Keeper, the Ventura River, actually flows into the Santa Barbara Channel. I do a lot of my work on the Ventura River. The Ventura River is actually in Region 4. It's the LA region. And last year, the LA region went through the process of renewing and adopting a new order for LA and Ventura counties. And so today, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to share some insights and some language from that process that's actually relevant and has bearing on what's been playing out in this region for the last many years. But so in September 2015, Steve mentioned the Coast Keeper ruling came through. It was right around then that the LA region was just about to renew its own order. And at that time, their plan, they had come up with a draft they hadn't circulated yet, but it closely resembled the previous order that they had in place. And that order very much resembled the 2005 order that the Central Coast had been implementing. But the Coast Keeper ruling happened, and so in October 2015, instead of renewing a new five-year program that would be an extension of their existing program, instead they had a six-month renewal, and it was explicitly for the purpose of considering the implications of the Judge Frawley ruling and interacting with various stakeholders and considering what that would mean for their new order. So a new stakeholder process was initiated. Both sides had extensive opportunity to have face-to-face meetings, calls, group meetings. And then in May 2016, so just 6 months later, a new conditional waiver was adopted by Region 4. And so I'm going to just quickly highlight a few key elements that were a direct result of consideration of the Central Coast ruling. So first, here, this is, it says, if monitoring results of the LA region, it's essentially the same in terms of the, there's an ambient kind of watershed monitoring program that growers, there's a group monitoring program that growers pay into, and samples are collected from surface waters. It says, if monitoring results demonstrate an exceedance of any water quality benchmark, and the individual discharger, and I apologize, I put the individual discharger requirement here. This also applies to the group, the discharge group. It's essentially the exact same language. But the discharger shall develop a water quality management plan and implement management practices in order to attain benchmarks. And here's the important part. Water quality benchmarks must be attained by the deadline specified in Table 2. So there's a table here with a whole list of compliance endpoints. And there's three things that I just want to note about this table. First of all, they, in this case, they chose to use compliance endpoints that are identified in TMDL programs. I just want to point out, if you scan those dates, that the vast majority of these compliance dates are in the relatively short term. We're talking the 5 to 10 year time frame, in some cases even within the time frame of this order itself. And then the last thing I want to point out is just for this region, and again, they have, for this region, this list is relatively comprehensive in terms of the types of pollutants in the watersheds that are likely being affected by irrigated agriculture. And the reason that they established these deadlines was listed or described in the staff report. And I quote here, they say, the schedule is needed to comply with the state non-point source policy, which requires specific time schedules and quantifiable milestones to measure progress to achieving water quality objectives. And they go on, they say, because water quality standards must ultimately be attained, the deadlines represent the time when the iterative management process should end. So continuing in the highlighted portion here, so water quality benchmarks, if TMDL associated water quality benchmarks are not attained by the deadlines identified in Table 2, then dischargers shall comply with discharge limitations using individual discharge monitoring as described in the appendix. So this means that if once they hit those deadlines, if they're still not achieving the water quality objective in that receiving water site, benchmarks turn into enforceable discharge limitations for growers. And all members that have sites draining to the discharge group monitoring site and all members with sites encompassing an adjacent watersheds must submit individual monitoring and reporting plans within 3 months and must do individual monitoring, okay? So samples should be collected from each individual discharge monitoring point once in wet, once in dry. It's interesting if there's a if they choose not to sample, they have to how is it described? If no dry sample is submitted, farmers must submit a formal declaration that no dry weather discharge actually occurs. So as it's written, the LA waiver incorporates major elements that are cited as essential in both Port of Cologne and the Central Coast ruling. It has one as mechanisms for meaningful verification monitoring. I'd point out there's no tiering structure in the LA program. If your receiving water isn't meeting an objective, everybody who drains to that receiving water must do individual discharge monitoring after a certain endpoint. And there's a compliance endpoint schedule with enforceable discharge limitations. And I believe both of these points are lacking currently in the order that's being proposed to you today. I think we all recognize the Central Coast has its own unique challenges, and there's certainly no one-size-fits-all program, and I don't propose that what's been adopted in L.A. is necessarily would work in the Central Coast region. But I think we should recognize that what L.A. did was significant, and it was heavily driven by what was approved here and eventually found to be inadequate. I also want to point out, I know it's, when I talk about the LA program with some people, there's a tendency to think, well, that's Los Angeles. It's just LA, right? But LA includes Ventura County. Ventura County farmers are just as much farmers as Central Coast farmers. There's over 100,000 acres of agricultural land in the region, 1,300 growers. I know that's significantly smaller than this region, but it's not insignificant. I note that there were no appeals, and the region and growers are currently implementing the order. And then just one more kind of story to share with you is the day of the hearing when the order was adopted. I remember out in the foyer outside, the Farm Bureau rep and some other stakeholders, some environmental stakeholders who participated in the meeting, were kind of, together talking about how the hearing just went. And somebody asked, the Farm Bureau representative what they thought, maybe what their plan was to begin planning with how to manage all this individual monitoring that could occur now in subsequent years. And I'm not quoting here, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially they said, well, they believed that everybody in the region in Ventura County was going to do everything in their power to avoid having to do individual discharge monitoring, because there's no way anybody wanted that to happen. And so all of their energy was going to be spent now on implementing best management practices to achieve water quality objectives. And so right there, and before the day was even over, I believe that region accomplished more with its program than has been accomplished here in years, in that there's an immediate motivation for growers to actually achieve water quality standards. And Steve's telling me that my time's up, so I'm going to turn it on over to Stanford. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Good afternoon, Chair Wolf, board members, and staff. My name is Elliot Higgins, and along with my colleague, Savannah Fletcher, we are law students from the Stanford Environmental Law Clinic, and we're here today to speak on behalf of Monterey Coastkeeper, a program of the Audit Project. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on Draft Agricultural Order 3.0. Now, I know it is late in the afternoon, and these legal arguments aren't the most exciting, but I thank you in advance for bearing with me. Today, I will argue that the draft order does not comply with the law for five reasons. First, it does not comply with the basin plan because it lacks enforceable measures and feedback mechanisms needed to meet the plan's water quality objectives. Second, it is not consistent with the non-point source policy. Third, it is not consistent with the anti-degradation policy. Fourth, it is not consistent with the Water Board's own stated positions. And finally, the Water Board has neglected its CEQA duty. Once I am finished, I will turn it over to Savannah, who will be making five arguments about why the draft order doesn't comply with the law as well. So the draft order violates Water Code Section 13269 for three reasons. First, the draft order does not comply with the basin plan because its iterative management approach lacks enforceable measures and feedback mechanisms needed to meet the plan's water quality objectives. It is unreasonable for the board to keep doing the same things it has been doing and expect different results. The Honorable Judge Timothy Frawley made this observation in his recent order declaring the Central Coast Regional Board's 2012 waiver to be illegal. Despite Judge Farley's holding, we are here today discussing an order that is nearly identical to the 2012 waiver. Indeed, the board continues to do the same thing and continues to expect different results. As an initial matter, we believe that an iterative process could be an appropriate approach to agricultural pollution. We recognize that immediate compliance with water quality standards is not possible without complete cessation of agricultural activity. Nonetheless, the waivers must include requirements reasonably designed to show measurable progress toward improving water quality over the short term and achieving water quality standards in a meaningful time frame. Unfortunately, this draft waiver that simply continues the 2012 approach cannot show measurable progress. The regulatory background of the Central Coast illustrates that this waiver is not a step in the right direction. Because agricultural discharges are non-point source discharges, historically they have been subject to minimal regulation. The regional board first approved a blanket waiver of WDRs for irrigation return flows and stormwater runoff in 1983. This waiver didn't require any monitoring or reporting. In response to a change in the law that required waivers to be consistent with applicable basin plans, include monitoring provisions, and expire after a five-year term, the regional board created the 2004 waiver. It aimed to achieve and maintain beneficial uses through education, voluntary unspecified management practices, and limited general water quality data gained through cooperative monitoring. However, the 2004 waiver did not require dischargers to meet specific targets, timelines, or monitoring requirements. Indeed, the 2004 waiver failed to stop the continuing degradation of water quality. Thus, from 2008 to 2012, the regional board developed a new waiver aimed at actually complying with water quality standards. But as it developed, the waiver became weaker and weaker under intense pressure from agricultural growers. In 2013, the State Board modified the already weakened Regional Board's waiver, further diminishing its effectiveness. The final modified waiver did not abate the continued pollution of Central Coast waters by agricultural dischargers. Accordingly, Judge Timothy Frawley held that the 2012 waiver was illegal. He found that it violated the California Water Code because it is not consistent with the basin plan, does not include adequate monitoring provisions, and is not in the public interest. The State Water Board has appealed Judge Frawley's holding, and we currently await the appellate court's decision. Nonetheless, the regional board is now considering a new draft waiver that is substantially similar to the illegal 2012 waiver, completely ignoring the ongoing litigation. Indeed, the current order, as Steve mentioned, is nearly identical to the order Judge Frawley already held to be illegal, and the Central Coast staff has stated this even today. Thus, the problems with the 2012 waiver persist in the draft order. Just like the 2012 waiver, this waiver is based on an iterative approach to attain water quality standards, by which dischargers must implement management practices to prevent or reduce discharges of waste. To the extent monitoring...
Can you slow down, please?
Of course.
I see smoke again.
No problem at all. To the extent monitoring data shows implemented management practices have not been effective in preventing discharges from causing or contributing to exceedances, the draft waiver requires the discharger to implement improved management practices. Unfortunately, the iterative management approach in its present form does not work for three reasons. The first problem is that there is no individual accountability due to cooperative monitoring group approach. Neither the board nor the cooperative monitoring group nor the grower can identify where the pollution is coming from or whether the grower's management practices are effectively reducing pollution and degradation. Problem two is that the draft order does not have meaningful standards. The draft waiver doesn't define what constitutes improved management practices, so compliance is achieved as long as the discharger implements a new management practice which the discharger believes will be an improvement. This is not adequate to ensure any meaningful progress toward achieving quantifiable reductions in pollutant discharges. The third problem, which Steve also discussed, is that most of the draft order's substantive provisions apply only to Tier 3 growers. However, the actual numbers show that only 0.5% of ranches, and 4.7% of total acreages are now in Tier 3. In sum, the draft order's iterative management approach violates the California Water Code. Implementing management practices is not a substitute for actual compliance with water quality standards. The draft order is not consistent with the State Board's non-point source policy. The Basin Plan incorporates the State Board's non-point source policy. The policy requires that any program to control non-point sources include sufficient feedback mechanisms for determining the program's efficacy. Non-point source programs must include management practices that permit the regional board to determine there is a high likelihood that the implementation program will attain the regional board's state water quality objectives. Quantifiable requirements and a specified time schedule, and sufficient feedback mechanisms to show that requirements are in fact being met. The draft waiver does not meet any of the non-point source policy requirements. As discussed, the board fails to demonstrate how the draft waiver will achieve the water quality objectives, let alone create a high likelihood of doing so. And again, there are not sufficient feedback mechanisms. The draft order is not consistent with the State Board's anti-degradation policy. Now, since I think I'm the third person to come up here to discuss anti-degradation policy, I will spare you this particular argument because I think you're already well aware of what I'm going to say. The draft order is inconsistent with the Water Board's own stated positions. The water boards, and when I say water boards, I mean the regional board and the state water board, have repeatedly argued that the 2012 waiver was just one step in an iterative approach to meet water quality standards. For example, in recent litigation, the board described the 2012 waiver as just the most recent step in an iterative process that requires a long-term commitment to achieve water quality objectives. Similarly, a regional board staff member testified that the 2012 order is just an iterative step. It's not the answer, it's just a step, and the next order will be another step. Yet, by presenting a new, essentially unchanged waiver, the board has explicitly chosen not to take another step toward achieving water quality objectives in violation of its own iterative approach. Additionally, the water boards have justified the 2012 waiver as an interim determination that the board would revisit once the expert panel concluded its study. In court, the State Board argued the 2012 waiver addressed several issues as an interim measure pending the conclusions of the expert panel. However, the expert panel completed its report on September 9, 2014, but the Board has failed to make substantive changes to its iterative order in light of the panel's findings. The fifth and final argument I will present today is that the Regional Board must conduct supplemental environmental review before adopting the 2017 order. In the draft order, the regional board relies on the environmental review prepared in 2009 for the 2012 agricultural order. The regional board cannot do so pursuant to CEQA. The state board did not conduct any further environmental review of the order as modified in 2013. Recognizing this failure, Judge Frawley required the state board to consider supplemental review in connection with the 2012 order. Moreover, new information has come to light since 2013 that further prompts the need for supplemental review. Tier 3 is covering far fewer growers. Growers have moved to more persistent and more broadly toxic pesticides. Therefore, the new order is less protective of water quality, and a new CEQA analysis is required. The regional board has a duty to review the new information and assess the ecological impacts before adopting the 2017 waiver. So thank you for your time, and now I will turn the podium over to my colleague, Savannah Fletcher, who will present our final five arguments.
Well, I think it's fair to say good evening, and as my colleague said, my name is Savannah Fletcher, and I will also be speaking on behalf of Monterey Coastkeeper, addressing why the current draft order fails to satisfy the board's duty under the public trust and how it fails to serve the public interest. I will go through 5 points. The regional board has a public trust obligation to ensure that the order balances and preserves trust resources to the extent feasible. Using the same order with its deficiencies is a violation of the board's public trust duty. The public trust is rooted in natural law principles going back centuries and requires the state manage all navigable waterways and their tributaries for the benefit of the people. In the case Illinois Central Railroad, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that the state holds public trust property in trust for the people of the state that they may enjoy the navigation of the waters, carry on commerce over them, and have liberty of fishing, free from the obstruction or interference of private parties. Today, the state's obligations go well beyond the fisheries, navigability, and commerce concerns that traditionally animated the public trust doctrine. These duties extend to protecting the public's ecological, recreational, and aesthetic interests in state waters and wildlife. As the court said in Marks v. Whitney, in administering the trust for state, the state is not burdened with an outmoded classification favoring one mode of utilization over another. There is a growing public recognition that one of the most important public uses is the preservation of those lands in their natural state so that they may serve as ecological units for scientific study, as open spaces, and as environments which provide food and habitat for birds and marine life. The courts have even more recently declared that wildlife are protected by the public trust doctrine because they are natural resources of inestimable value to the community as a whole. Additionally, the public trust waters and groundwater of the Central Coast region are interconnected, and any pollution entering surface waters can seep into groundwater supplies. The groundwater in this region is pumped to private wells and used for domestic consumption, as has been extensively discussed today. Consequently, there is an even greater responsibility to keep this water clean in the interest of public health. As previous speakers have detailed, the order in its current state fails to protect the ecological, recreational, wildlife, and aesthetic interests of this public resource because high level of nitrates and toxics kill marine life and detract from the beauty of the region by diminishing its health. The table pictured is just one example of increasing levels of nitrates in the water supply. The harm to public waters can be stopped, however. The Central Coast Water Board has broad powers to do everything necessary to protect the public trust. As expressed in City of Long Beach versus Mansell, the implied powers of the state as trustee include everything necessary to the proper administration of the trust. The board has the power to exercise continuous supervision and control over the public trust waters. The Supreme Court of California has held that this control prevents any party from acquiring a vested right to appropriate water in a manner harmful to interests protected by the public trust. Currently, public trust interests are being harmed by the private interests of agriculture that use excessive amounts of nitrates and toxics for their crops, which discharge into public waters. The interests of agriculture should not outweigh all other uses of public water. The cleanliness of water for recreation, the natural beauty of the Central Coast, and especially the health of the ecosystem and the individuals living here must be considered by the board when amending the order. The public trust places an affirmative duty upon the government to protect public trust resources. The court in National Audubon Society said that the state has an obligation to exercise a continuous supervision and control over the navigable waters of the state in the public's best interest and cannot neglect or end these duties. Moving on to my second point, the order violates the reasonable use doctrine by permitting the continued degradation to the region's waters. It is unreasonable to permit the continued degradation of the region's waters by allowing irrigated agriculture to go unchecked, particularly where simple, known practices can be implemented to control agricultural discharges. Moreover, it is unreasonable to permit agricultural operations in the region to continue operating under a waiver that has proven ineffective for ensuring water is capable of serving all the beneficial uses for which it has been designated. The reasonable use doctrine in Section 100 of the California Water Code commands the Central Coast Board to consider the many critical functions the region's waters serve and the variety of beneficial uses to which the region's waters are put.
Could you slow down?
Slow down? Sorry, yes. Time concerns. Not only agriculture, we must consider all of these beneficial uses. The reasonable use doctrine is enshrined in the California Constitution, which provides that water use shall be limited to amounts reasonably required for the beneficial use, and such right does not extend to waste or unreasonable use. While undoubtedly important, agriculture is but one of the many designated beneficial uses of water in the region, and often at the expense of other important societal interests. The reasonable use doctrine has been interpreted to provide this water board with broad authority to ensure that our state's water resources are used in a manner that best serves the public interest including direct enforcement of the reasonable use mandate when a particular use becomes unreasonable. Although there is no single definition of a reasonable use of water, the California courts have long recognized the duty of the state board to balance competing demands when considering what is reasonable, including consideration of environmental impacts. Indeed, the California courts have repeatedly affirmed the state board's assertion of reasonable use powers in order to improve or maintain water quality, and have emphasized the protection of fish, wildlife, and other in-stream uses are equally important societal interests that must be taken into account when defining what is reasonable. The state constitution and California Water Code provide the board with broad authority. You all have broad authority here, and you should use that to craft a waiver that is consistent with the public interest and sufficiently protective of water quality as the law requires. My third point is that the order as it is currently written is not in the public interest. Water is the lifeblood of the Central Coast region. The Central Coast region stretches from a portion of San Mateo County in the north to Santa Barbara County in the south. Encompassed are rugged seacoasts where land dramatically meets the sea. And here, recreation and tourism economies depend not only on its famed scenic waterways and bays, such as Monterey Bay, Morro Bay, and the Santa Barbara Channel, but also the abundant wildlife that healthy watersheds support, including within the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. The region's river and streamside habitats support some of the most significant biodiversity of any temperate region in the world. Some of the last remaining populations of the California sea otter, the endangered steelhead, endangered coho salmon, and other imperiled species. The region has also historically supported prolific commercial fisheries, clam beds, and shell fishing and sport fishing grounds important to the state's economy. Aside from serving a critical role in the state's economy, the region's water sustains human life. Municipal and domestic wells supply 90% of the region's drinking water, supporting millions of residents. Although the region's sources of drinking water supplies are limited, and adequate quality water for many beneficial uses is in short supply. And yet, pollution has extensively and severely devastated this vital and dwindling resource. Indisputably, irrigated agriculture is the primary actor responsible for this water pollution. Nearly every water body in the lower Salinas Valley, for example, is impaired by harmful pollutants associated with agriculture, such as nutrients, pesticides, and sediment, according to the state and the US EPA. Irrigated agriculture depends on pumped local groundwater and drainage systems that carry contaminated runoff away from farms. The region's 17,000 miles of streams and rivers, as they twist through 435,000 acres of converted farmland that once was a mosaic of salt ponds, grasslands, and wetlands, as seen in photos from Steve, collect agricultural runoff before percolating into underground aquifers or spilling into the ocean, including the Monterey Bay. This water pollution from irrigated agriculture prevents a significant threat to human health. For this reason, the board must follow the human right to water policy, as outlined by groups before me. And the human right to water is an established policy of California, which declares the right of every human being to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water adequate for human consumption, cooking, and sanitary purposes. In the state of California, the highest use of water is for domestic purpose, and only the next highest use is for irrigation. The board is mandated to consider these codified policies in adopting the waiver. The State Water Board, in response to the codification of the human right to water, declared in 2015 that its mission is to preserve, enhance, and restore the quality of California's water resources and drinking water for the protection of the environment, public health, and all beneficial uses, and to ensure proper water resources allocation and efficient use for the benefit of present and future generations. This resolution addresses discharges into water that could threaten human health, stating they are among the Water Board's highest priorities, and such discharges should be regulated to attain the highest water quality, which is reasonable. The legislature left it up to the Water Boards, this Water Board, to ensure the state's policy be implemented. Yet the draft waiver fails to consider the human right to water. The regional board fails to analyze how the draft waiver achieves a policy to provide water in compliance with the human right to water. Nor does it analyze how many communities and residents will be left without safe drinking water, the costs to those communities that result from the contamination, or even provide a timeline when these communities can expect to have safe drinking water. The draft order renders the human right to water a mere goal, which the regional board thus far has not successfully achieved. And my fifth point is that the regional water board could be liable for creating a public nuisance if more stringent orders are not passed. California courts have held that if plaintiffs believe that the Board of Supervisors or any other agency or subdivision of the state has failed to discharge its responsibilities under the public trust, they may bring an appropriate action against those agencies. California Civil Code 3479 defines nuisance as anything which is injurious to health, or is indecent or offensive to the senses, or unlawfully obstructs the free passage or use in the customary manner of any navigable lake, or river, bay, stream, canal, or basin. The water agency has set standards that are harmful to the public water quality and public health. If the order as it currently stands is approved, the Regional Water Board could be liable for failing to meet its responsibilities under the public trust. Multiple cases dating back to Turlock v. Bristow in 1930 up to Newhall Land and Farming Company and Selma Pressure Treating Company in the 1990s have found water pollution to be a public nuisance. In failing to enforce more stringent discharge regulations, the Water Board creates a public nuisance. The Board must take concrete action that will actually guarantee a limit to these incoming contaminants. Fortunately, this Water Board knows how to address the issue and has the tools to do so with this 2017 order. Looking to the guidelines laid out by Judge Frawley for the 2012 order and the many wonderful suggestions provided by those speaking today is a wonderful starting point for a 2017 order that will truly protect the public trust and serve the public's interest in clean water for all uses. Thank you so much for your time and patience, and we would like to reserve our remaining 5 minutes. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So, how's the hands? All right.
Dr. Wolf, I have a procedural question about reserving the additional 5 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to ask for clarification. What did we mean by that, Steve?
So in the past, there have been speakers. We haven't not done it, but other speakers have done it where they said basically what they want is to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And that has been granted. In 2012.
Well, we're at 2000,
right.
We're on 2017
so if
today.
You're not going to do okay. that, I'm fine. Just don't do that for anybody. That's all I'm saying.
All
so
right.
we set it. If you say no, we're fine with that.
Because I gave you an extra 5 minutes, remember?
Yes, you did.
All right.
And so we still have it? Is that what you're saying?
If you want to use your 5 minutes, go ahead. But
what we're saying is, so what we're asking is to reserve that extra 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Rebuttal to what?
Other speakers at the end, which has been granted in the past.
We're not in 2012, so this time we're not going to have rebuttal to
okay,
other
that's
speakers.
Fine. That was the question,
okay.
and the question has been answered.
All right.
Thank you.
Very good. So at this time, I'm going to look at my left. If we have any question for staff, okay. And any question to Mr. Shemek and his team?
Yeah.
Right, so Mr. Young.
So Mr. Shemek, the question that Mr. Kane wouldn't defer to you was, how do you limit, how would the water board limit pesticides so as not to be contributing to an exceedance in receiving water?
Thank you for the question, and that's a good question. So first of all, it would start with including the entire list of pesticides instead of just chlorpyrifos and diazinon that could impact waters. And that way, any grower using those pesticides that were known to cause impacts to surface water quality or toxicity and or groundwater would automatically go into Tier 3. And so then they would have to do individual reporting requirements, and you would be able to then put numeric discharge requirements on those discharges.
Well, and that's my question. what numeric discharge limits.
I think many
you
of these,
think
so. I don't know that every pesticide has a numeric or a numeric discharge limit. I believe that many pesticides do have numeric discharge limits, have been established for many.
So it's a do not exceed number.
Yes. So in other words, if toxicity is found, if they are using those chemicals, and but this would be an extensive list of chemicals, then they would have to do individual monitoring because they are now in tier three, and you would be able to place numeric limits on those discharges because it would be a discharge limitation, just like any other industrial or discharger has. You would be able to place those limits, I believe. Again, I'm a biologist, you guys.
And do you have any understanding for why pesticide use has gone up the last 4 years? Has more acreage been put into production?
So those numbers came straight from DPR, and there really was no analysis that I saw in why those numbers. It was remarkable that the numbers had gone up. They did remark that the numbers had gone up when previous to 2008 they had been going down. But there was no discussion that I saw of why those numbers were going up. So the best answer that I can give is I don't know.
And as for best management practices for pesticide usage, sounded like from what we heard earlier today, it's simply following the labeling requirements.
Right. And as you commented, I think right is correctly, as I recall the testimony of Department of Pesticide Regulation when they were here, they said that although they did have some requirement that they protect the environment as well, they were behind the curve in coming up with that kind of protective requirement, and they were more their labeling instructions were more about protecting human health. And so that's a problem. You don't really have label. If you rely upon those labeling instructions, you're not relying on something protective of the environment. My second point would be, and I just recalled this, and I'll be very brief in this, is one of the problems that you currently have that relates to this toxicity issue is that you have created a series of, TMDLs, I'm sorry, TMDLs for toxicity, and for municipalities, it actually creates discharge limitations, numeric discharge limitations in some of those TMDLs. But for agriculture, it basically says that if you are complying with the agricultural order, you are deemed to be in compliance with the TMDL. So now what you've got is an order that is basically emphasizing chlorpyrifos and diazinon that are no longer being used, and then you have toxicity which is being caused by other chemicals. You don't have the associations that you need between an effective ag order and the TMDL.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Schimmick, you spoke extensively about how much time this board has had to consider various pieces of information and take them into account in formulating this waiver. And without getting into the back and forth of that and the merits of that, we are where we are today.
Yes.
If we do not pass this, if we do not pass a waiver of some sort in the next few days, we will have some extended period of time of no regulation or of no regulatory order. And Certainly, were we to make the kinds of changes which you're proposing, almost any of them would require a new comment period.
Yes.
So I understand your frustration with your perception of how much time we've had and what product is being delivered today. Do you think we should reject this waiver in any case? And what do you think are the consequences of that?
Right. So first of all, I do respect and understand where you're at today. And I don't believe that it is possible. In fact, I know it is not possible for you to make the changes that I'm requesting and that many speakers are requesting today or tomorrow, you know, and then pass something because you haven't noticed it. You haven't given the public. And I will get to the answer to the question. I also just want to acknowledge that I appreciate the fact that you understand my frustration. I truly do. I'm torn because I think that formally I've got to stand up here and say, you know, I oppose passage of this waiver. I think that's the stance that I have to take. Do I think you're going to pass it? Yes. Do I think that you're, excuse the language and it'll be a court reporter, but damned if you do and damned if you don't? Yes, I think you're in that position. You know, we will petition this. And that will take my time, that will take your time, that will take everybody's time. But frankly, and I don't want to get anyone in trouble, so I won't name names, but literally a member of the state board legal staff told me, you're going to have to petition this if they pass it. And I mean, it's just the process we have to follow, right? There's the potential that it could hurt our current case if we don't object to what you do today. So we have to do that. So I have to formally oppose passage of this waiver.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah. And again, I appreciate the position you're in.
So I think you acknowledge to some extent the position where the board is and some of the delays that we have in the interim 3.0 versus 4.0. Some of it is driven around the fact that we do have some pending legal challenges that needs to be addressed. So we have to be on solid ground. Otherwise, we would find ourselves possibly in 6 months being in violation. So there's prudence here of taking a little step forward. And then after passing of 3.0, then in good faith, our staff can start working on the 4.0. So that's one point I wanted to make. Please go ahead.
You know, first of all, I would go back to my comments and say, you know, okay, the state, you know, referenced the Judge Frawley's decision in creating the East San Joaquin, so they were able to adjust, and also LA Board was able to adjust and pass something that considered Judge Frawley's decision. So I think that it's a false choice a little bit to say. So is it a false choice to say, can we do this in one week that you have left before it expires? No, it's not a false choice. You can't do it in 1 week. But to say, oh, this is what led to the delays, well, it didn't delay East San Joaquin, and it didn't delay L.A. They were able to get it done, taking into account. Now, not done as far as East San Joaquin goes. That's going to be a forever process.
I was going to say, it's not
Yeah, it's but not, LA is.
Not done.
And you know, and so...
No, but, let me finish for a second.
Yeah, okay, go
it's
ahead.
It's not... It's in progress. I mean, right now we keep getting quotes in terms of Judge Folley. You know, and I know that it's, you know, that matter is still being addressed.
We do know that, but we also know that very likely East San Joaquin is going to come out, and either agriculture isn't going to like it, or we're not going to like it, and it's going to end up in litigation, and it still won't be done. So I actually really enjoyed and had never thought about what Mr. Kane said when he said, so what happens if we lose our case at Coast Keeper? What will you do then? Will you ignore the fact that you have, you know, toxic waters throughout the region? Will you ignore the fact that you have growers over applying fertilizers? Or, you know, so I actually think that what you have to do is frankly do a good order, and it basically ignores all this legal stuff, and you do a good order and see, and that's going to be your strongest position, in my opinion. Will it be litigated? Yes, but that will be your strongest position, and I think that that's actually the weakness that you're in right now. You did a compromise order last time. And it's my belief that your job is not to drive down the middle of the road. Your job is to protect water quality. I believe that last time you did not.
So let me switch gear for a moment. And this ties to the DPR reports. When you look at the DPR reports on annual pesticides use, its total amount of pesticide for the year. It does not normalize it based on acreage. So if you do have an increase of acreage, you can, you know, potentially have an increase in application use. So there's that point. The other one.
And there has been an increase in acreage. In other words, we do know that.
Right.
It's a separate report, not that report. But the acreage did increase in Monterey County.
So, and when we say the increase of acreage, it also gets back to, you know, the cases where you may have 100 acres, but you went from two crops per year to three crops per year, which indirectly also increase, you know, the acreage. The other aspect sometime with pesticide application reports that can be at the surface not encouraging, but there is a reason behind, and those are the seasonal changes due to weather. For instance, most likely in 2017, at the end of 2017, I'll use my uncalibrated crystal ball. And I will predict that the mildicide application is going to go way up compared to 2016. Okay, so you know, sometimes we got to correlate those things, and then just as a little sidebar, with application of neonicotinoids in vineyards, often those are used for mealybugs. And there are alternatives utilizing IPM, integrated pest management,
right,
where you use a combination of beneficial insect release, such as the Flotolucas, mating disruptors with pheromone cards, Argentinian ant traps, etc. So, you know, when you're looking at techniques that can be used and the tools available, you know, IPM is certainly one of the alternatives that can be used.
To address two of your points, the last one first, the IPM use, I agree. I totally agree. And so what I believe is that you should be down-tiering people that do not represent a threat mm-hmm. to water quality. And I think that what you saw was, and I think what was frankly told to you at several meetings ago by the executive director of the SIP program was one that people paid their money and they had never not taken somebody in, and two, which is kind of remarkable, and two, that they use imidacloprid, which has now been found to be a rather, you know, not extreme chemical, but a toxic and persistent chemical and a threat to groundwater. And so the question before you is, do you continue to down-tier programs like SIP? Now, I'm not saying that you can't down-tier any program. I hope that a program comes along that you can, with a straight face, down-tier, because I still believe in prioritization, and it would be good to get some things off the table so that you can focus on other things. The other point I want to make is your point about, you know, sometimes you have two croppings, multiple croppings, instead of just one croppings because of new technology or new drivers, new markets. And I know that I'm probably about to get a gasp from behind me, but I think that there is a tension between protecting water quality and maximizing agricultural profits. And I don't know that you necessarily have a responsibility to maximize agricultural profits. I do think you have a responsibility to protect water quality. And I'm not saying that I think it's a false choice to say, well, you're saying, asking us to pick between agricultural or water quality. That's not what I'm asking. I'm simply saying, I simply believe optimistically that if you challenge agriculture to do it with less impact, they can do it. I believe that. You have the smartest growers in the world. They can do it. There just has to be a real challenge in front of them. You need to backstop this with regulation.
Okay, thank you. And at this time, do we have additional question for staff before they provide a response?
I do. Do we have to be out of here at 5:30? Mr. Chair, because I don't mind giving my questions to staff and getting the answer tomorrow if that's the case. But if we don't, that's fine too.
I think it's good to, you know, finish this item.
Okay. I have three questions then.
Sure.
The first is Mr. Schimmick referred to 24 growers in Tier 3, of which 10 said that they had no discharges and therefore were exempt from some or all reports. And he said he hoped that we had confirmed that they had no discharges. So that's my first question. My second I'll just give them to you all at once, and you can take them in any order you want. My second, we heard quite a bit about the LA order and how it had clear timelines and benchmarks. And did the LA – I saw nothing in there about groundwater. Did the LA order touch on groundwater at all? And if not, is that because it's not an issue there or simply because they're simply not there in the process? And third, does the public trust doctrine, we heard quite a bit about that, does that apply to groundwater?
I can answer the last question and part of the second question. The public trust doctrine does not apply to groundwater. With respect to the LA order, it does have some requirements for nitrate in groundwater. I have it with me, and I can look at it and give you a better answer tomorrow. The requirements were not universal. As I recall, the requirements to prepare nutrient management plans were tied to areas where there were known surface water impairments for nitrate. That order was much more focused on surface water, and as you saw from one of the slides, it was very driven by TMDL-based requirements for surface waters. Those TMDLs had very specific requirements, unlike the Region 3 TMDLs, and because the TMDLs were in the basin plan, the requirements had to be included in the order. My recollection is also that they were fairly close to attaining those surface water objectives. So there are a lot of distinctions between that order and this one. And it's not really appropriate to look at one order and say, well, we could do the same thing here. Maybe you could, but not based on the record of this action.
Chris Rose with the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. Yes, I think out of the 10, we did inspections, drive-by inspections, without telling the grower, basically to see if there was a discharge, and we could find no evidence of discharge. With respect to the others, it's a self-reporting program, and they reported that they did not have a discharge. We did these drive-bys, couldn't find a discharge, and so we trusted it.
Lori, question for you. I thought that the public trust doctrine does apply to groundwater when it's hydraulically connected to surface water, and I thought that's what the Scott River case held.
There's one case based on unique circumstances that I am not that well versed in, but in terms of whether it applies to what we're talking about today, the surface discharges of waste and their impacts on groundwater, unrelated to the hydraulic connection between surface and groundwater, it wouldn't apply to those discharges. The other thing to keep in mind is that this isn't a water rights proceeding. There are obviously water quality elements of the public trust, but they're basically coextensive with the requirements that you're implementing anyway. Porter-Cologne also the requirements of Porter-Cologne are designed to effectuate the legislative intent that the board considers the competing demands on beneficial uses and the various uses to be made of water. So, and the board has considered that in terms of balancing all these requirements. Obviously, we've made it clear that this is an iterative process and we're not there yet, but the considerations are similar, and the public trust doesn't provide any additional remedies to Porter-Cologne. So the remedy for a public trust violation would be the same as saying you're not upholding your Porter-Cologne requirements, which would be a writ saying do something more or do something better.
Thank you. Any other response that you have?
No, Mr. Chair, I have nothing else unless the board has something for me. Thank you.
Okay. All right. See none. Thank you.
Apparently, I think is.
No, we're not going to go back and forth.
Okay.
We haven't done that for other folks either. So, but sorry. Otherwise, you know, we'll comment and then we'll have more comments, and I just want to be fair and consistent with everyone. So at this time, Mr. Rose, you do not have any additional input that you want to provide to the board pertaining to the presentations done by Mr. Shemek and his team, correct?
No, Mr. Chair. I believe that we've responded to these comments in our response to comments as well as oral comment today in our responses.
All right. So I thank everyone, and it is 5:36. And this will end our Tuesday, March 7, 2017, Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. And we will reconvene tomorrow at
9 o'clock.
9 a.m. Thank you.